Today's lecture is obviously about Freud. It may seem a bit kind of weird in the sequence. Obviously, as you know, the previous Freud lecture was postponed, and I've sort of taken it on from week two. So we've gone from Spivak to Freud, which might seem a bit weird, but we'll give it a go. Okay. I know some of you collect sort of biographical details and dates, so I thought I'd just introduce Freud biographically, really, so that you can just for your own interest, really. Freud was born on the 6th of May, 1856, and after excelling in his early education, enrolled at the medical faculty of the University of Vienna in 1873, after reconsidering his initial decision to study law. In 1876, he won an apparently highly coveted grant to do research on the gonads of eels at the Zoological Experimental Station of the University of Vienna. I'm sure we're all better off for having seen all that research. Freud went on to obtain his medical degree, embarked on extensive research on cocaine, which he recommended to his fiancée because he thought that it would bring a glow to her cheeks. And in 1888, started publishing articles on neurological and psychiatric subjects. Freud began the work for which he's now most famous in Vienna during 1886, where he opened a private practice for the treatment of hysteria. By 1896, before his 40th birthday, Freud had begun to use his personal term psychoanalysis to describe his mode of therapy. Freud died aged 83 in September 1939, leaving behind a legacy as profound and as comparable as the likes of Plato and Shakespeare. For some critics, such as Harold Bloom, Freud's influence and legacy is such that we are in a sense all Freudians, whether we like to be or not. Indeed, Freud is much more than a perpetual fashion, Bloom argues. He seems to have become a culture, our culture. It is Freud's unique stature, his pervasive influence, which now characterises his achievement, an achievement that has wide-ranging ramifications for the study of everything, from psychology and philosophy through to literature and religion. Freud's work is undoubtedly divisive, and even today many people either dismiss his ideas entirely or prefer to avoid them because of their depth and complexity. But these attitudes, Freud would argue at least, are merely evidence of deep-seated hang-ups and repression, and despite of their dismissal of psychoanalysis, these individuals are probably those most in need of it. Foremost in Freud's work was his interpretation of dreams of 1900. Despite being written over a century ago, the work is still widely acknowledged as an astonishing, daring and insightful performance. Freud conceived of the work as the pinnacle of his achievement and prefaced the third edition of 1931 with the comment that insight such as this falls to one's lot but once in a lifetime. But the interpretation of dreams was highly contentious. For one thing, as Freud himself realised, by assigning dreams meanings that could be understood and deciphered, he was in some respects taking the side of unlettered folklore and the superstitious, who had always conceived of dreams as having significance, either divine or otherwise. In some respects, then, Freud's stance was at odds with the mainstream psychology and philosophy of the time, which dismissed anything that was not self-evidently empirical. Nevertheless, Freud's work on dreams was highly significant and influential. The relevance of Freud's work for literary studies may seem a little tenuous at the moment, but I'm going to focus on the applicability of psychoanalysis, and in particular Freud's theory of dreams and daydreaming here. Well, first we need to revisit Freud's central ideas, partly for revision, but mainly because the particular apparatuses associated with dream work are precisely those that some critics have argued are the most applicable to the composition and analysis of literature. So forgive me if I'm going over old ground here, because I'm obviously not quite sure what was covered in other people's seminars. One of the principal ideas in Freud's theories concerning the human mind was the idea that there exists an arena of thought that is not subject to conscious will. The unconscious, Freud believed, is a repository of repressed desires, feelings, memories and instinctual drives, many of which are directly related to sexuality, the body and violence. Freud went on to argue that our mental lives largely derive from biological drives, but as an individual grows and enters into society, many of the instinctual and bodily drives that lurk within us have to be repressed. Our initially grandiose sense of self and our sexual impulses have to be moulded and restrained in order to fit into the norms and behavioural patterns dictated by society. In other words, socialisation converts animalistic instincts into civil behaviour. This process creates what Julie Rivkin and Michael Ryan have aptly called a stranger within. This stranger can sometimes reveal itself to us in our conscious lives, and Freud points to the uncanny feelings of doubleness and the sometimes perverse compulsion to repeat certain gestures, desires or experiences, even though they are in themselves distressing, as evidence of unconscious drives or memories transgressing into our everyday lives. Unconscious animalistic desires can sometimes surface when we least expect it, or because certain scenarios are favourable to unconscious desires revealing themselves. It is interesting, for example, that in The Buddha of Suburbia, Karim comes face to face with this problem when he's with Eleanor, Freudian slip there. Initially, Karim is relatively inexperienced sexually, but after repeated and ever more experimental episodes with Eleanor, Karim realises that there is more to his sexual exploits than simple passion. "Here we were," Karim tells us, "a fond and passionate pair. But to reach climax, I found myself wondering what creatures men were that saw rapes, massacres, tortures and eviscerations at such moments of union. I was being tormented by devils. I kept feeling that terrible things would happen." That's on page 207, if anyone wants to look it up. What is interesting about this passage is the ambiguity inherent in his confession that he wonders what creatures men were that visualised such scenes during sex. This line could indicate that Karim is wondering why some men think such things, and he is thus distancing himself from such fantasies. On the other hand, he could be assessing the reasons why men in general, including himself, think about such things. The fact that such topics enter his head during sex, and have to in order for him to climax, indicates that he is actually visualising such scenes in reference to his own subliminal desires. His confession that he is being tormented by devils and fears that terrible things could happen further testify to the sense that such images are entering his head uninvited, and he is clearly extremely anxious that this stranger within might ultimately take over. The passage immediately following the one I've outlined here is also interesting. Following Karim's concerns that terrible things could happen, he states, "When Alan and I finished gutting the flat, and before Ted and Eva could get started on it, I spent some time with Jita and Jamila. All I wanted was to work in the shop in the evening and earn a bit of money." The subject here has shifted rapidly from the operations of the mind to the comparative mundanity of earning a living. In other words, the conscious mind has quickly reasserted control and returned Karim back to within the norms of societal behaviour. Freud argued that the mind has the ability to repress unwanted, if not potentially terrible, ideas, and this tendency is clearly what Qureshi is exploring here. Freud distinguished two forms of repression. Primal repression, Freud believed, initiates the formation of the unconscious itself. Prior to socialisation, the mind has neither a conscious or an unconscious, but is simply a mass of instinctual drives. Freud cannot account for how such drives find representation within the mind, but hypothesises that instincts become bound to thoughts and images in the course of early experiences of pain and pleasure. The mechanism of repression which is more familiar to us, and is of greater relevance to us here, is that of repression proper, or after pressure. This mechanism of repression serves to keep guilt-laden wishes, violence, memories and certain sexual drives out of conscious experience. It is the understanding and breaking down of this repression that forms the bedrock of psychoanalysis. For Freud and psychoanalysis more generally, in the unconscious the body refuses to take on the social mould that has been imposed upon it. Indeed, it is probably impossible for it to do so, since socialisation is in direct contrast to our original animalistic impulses. That said, Freud argues that the conscious mind is actually convinced that the body is submitted to socialisation, but this is a form of self-deception. Throughout life, we inevitably experience various invasions from the unconscious, but as with Karim, repression enables us to successfully suppress such thoughts and desires, even when they do surface. However, crucially, none of these desires are ever wholly surrendered, No phase of development ever fully suppresses them. They are constantly there, in the background, and as we develop into adults, become ever more complex and at odds with our innate animalistic sexual urges and predilection towards violence. As individuals, we are forever haunted by the mismatch between bodily and unconscious desire and the sexual cum social role that society requires of us. We learn in part to deal with this inherent contradiction through our socialisation, but if the process has been short-circuited somewhere, the mismatch between bodily and unconscious desires and our conscious social role becomes increasingly pronounced and leads ultimately to neurotic and psychotic disorders. In therapy, the mechanism of repression, although somewhat faulty, still dominates even the neurotic. Censorship and the counterforce exerted upon the unconscious by the ego mean that whenever unconscious desires or unconscious thoughts or desires do surface, they do so in disguise, or what Freud called a compromise formations. It is the nature of these disguises that has preoccupied psychoanalysis, and Freud constantly strived throughout his life to find ways of circumventing this repression so as to gain a clearer understanding of what was going on in the unconscious mind of his patients. To this end, Freud advocated a technique called free associating, and he encouraged his patients to simply speak whatever came into their minds without attempting to censor what was being said or even structure it into any kind of coherent sentences or arguments. Nevertheless, the material Freud gleaned from such scenarios, because it was necessarily communicated to him through language, was still encoded, if you like, and needed to be interpreted by the therapist in order to understand the true underlying operations of the patient's mind. One of the main ways of assessing and interpreting the operations of the unconscious mind, Freud believed, was through the analysis of dream work. Dreams have a privileged place in Freud's metapsychology. They are, he said, the royal road to a knowledge of the unconscious activities of the mind. In the condition of sleep, the force of repression and the ego is relaxed, Freud argued, because there is no immediate likelihood of unconscious impulses being carried through into dangerous action. Nevertheless, repression and censorship do still operate during sleep, albeit to a lesser extent. And although unconscious desires and impulses surface to a greater extent than during our waking hours, repression prevents us from attempting to act them out, thereby helping to ensure we remain asleep. Freud thus proposed that dreams are actually the guardians of sleep and not its disturbers. For Freud, the energising force of dreams stems from an unconscious impulse seeking fulfilment, a desire that in waking life is not fulfilled. Because such impulses do not find expression in our waking lives, in sleep they attach themselves, as it were, to material from recent experience and recollections from events occurring over the past few days. This material then draws upon further material and emotions from distant memories involving infantile sexual wishes. The unconscious wish strives for satisfaction through expression, but the censorship, the repression that such wishes meet with on the frontier between the unconscious and the preconscious, will not permit these powerfully charged memories and desires to reach representation within the conscious mind in their original form. As I've mentioned, this censorship or repression can be seen as a safety mechanism that not only prevents dream thoughts becoming action and thereby waking us up, but such censorship also protects us from memories that we may not be able to cope with. A perfect example of this in waking life, when repression is at its strongest, is the common occurrence of amnesia in victims of trauma, particularly sexual trauma during childhood. In dreams, however, the original material and the desires that have aligned themselves with that material is transformed into images and form the content of the dream. The essence of dream images, then, is disguise, but the actual influence of repression varies considerably. The repression may be total, in which case the encodings of the dream will be extremely obscure, whilst on the other hand, some material might slip through the net and be less obviously encoded. In either case, Freud argues, the dream is a compromise between the demands of impulse and the intensity of the repression. Freud distinguishes between what he calls the manifest content of a dream and its latent content. The manifest content are the images, dialogue and narrative framework that we remember when we wake up, whilst the latent content can only really be discovered through careful analysis. Latent content is the original forbidden dream thoughts and emotions that have become encrypted as a result of repression and censorship. Latent content goes piece by piece into the dream stories by a series of associations and images. The task of the analysis is to effectively reverse this process in order to decode the dream and discover its underlying or latent meanings. In terms of the process of dreaming, the mechanics of how a dream is actually formulated, remembered, and then articulated to others, Freud argued that four main operations are undertaken by the mind, namely condensation, displacement, considerations of representability, and finally secondary revision. Condensation effectively does what it says on the tin. Condensation is directly responsible for the formation of the manifest dream content and constructs it in such a way as to be a highly abbreviated version of the latent dream thought. Composite images and narratives are created, but crucially, very little is actually left out. Dream images and narratives are frequently highly complex and manifest sometimes seemingly contradictory elements, hence why some images we remember can appear extremely disjointed, if not perverse. However, for Freud, this is because there are a multitude of latent dream elements that become condensed or compressed into a highly abbreviated version of their original. The second factor influencing dream work is displacement. Displacement, he said, is the most powerful instrument of the dream censorship. The images and scenarios we remember as part of the manifest content of the dream are chains of associations that disguise the underlying latent content of the dream. The original ideas or desires emerge as something far removed from their original, and in this respect they are an integral part of the process of condensation. The two processes are mutually interdependent. Freud is keen to stress that what we may, during our recollection of a dream, considers as unintelligible or trivial, is not an indicator of its lack of significance, but its opposite, and is the effect of condensation and displacement working together under the influence of repression and censorship to prevent our underlying desires and impulses coming to the surface. Indeed, it could be argued that the greater the apparent triviality of the images and narratives we remember, the greater the importance that ought to be attached to decoding them, as clearly repression and censorship have exerted considerable influence in these instances. The fragmentary, displaced and seemingly contradictory nature of the manifest dream content, then, is a disguise, and Freud argues that rather than being seemingly random, insignificant or incomprehensible, dreams do have their own logic and their own language. That language and the manner in which the latent dream thoughts are expressed is directly contrary to waking logic, but it is the very absurdity of dream structure that underpins and actually proves the validity of Freud's theory, according to Freud himself, of course. The third activity of dream work is considerations of representability. In many respects, this activity can be said to govern the operations of the former activities, in that the latent content of the dream, the underlying mass of contradictory impulses, desires and memories that lie simmering in the unconscious, must reveal themselves in a manner that, although encoded and distorted, are at least immediately recognisable. In other words, emotions, desires, impulses and the like become represented symbolically via images, metaphors and similes. At a very basic level, considerations of representability is about how and why the manifest content of the dream consists in the form of pictorial images that can be comprehended and recollected by the mind. This pictorial and narrative representation is the language of dream work, its method of communicating and representing complex ideas and feelings in a manner that the conscious mind can recognise, even if it cannot immediately make sense of them. Freud refers to this process as akin to the difficult task of representing the arguments from a political article in a newspaper or the speeches of counsel before a law court through only a set of pictures. Such a task is almost impossible to the conscious mind, but this is precisely what dream work has to do if it is to express the underlying desires, wishes and impulses of the unconscious in a recognisable yet encoded fashion. In the case of secondary revision, the dream undergoes a further layer of distortion and censorship. The psychoanalyst is not the first interpreter of the dream, Freud suggested. Rather, the conscious mind, when we are awake, tries to impose some form of logic upon the mass of material inherent to the manifest dream content we remember upon waking. This revision is particularly important when we try to relate the dream to another, either verbally or in writing. The conscious mind, by its very nature, attempts to put the irrational dream content into a recognisable, familiar and sequential order so as to enable it to be communicated through language. In doing so, this secondary revision imposes a further distortion of the distortion that has already been achieved by the other three mechanisms. This revision does not necessarily alter the dream material itself, rather it is the arrangement or presentation of it that undergoes revision. That said, as I'm sure you have all experienced, some material can be deliberately excluded, either to produce an acceptable rational narrative or because the conscious mind dictates that the material that has surfaced, despite its displacement, is still too contrary to the dictates imposed upon us by socialisation to be communicated to others. To my mind, though, there is yet another level of distortion operating here. Freud is primarily concerned with the tendency of the conscious mind to revise the dream material into a relatively logical and communicable narrative, particularly in the verbal account given to the therapist. But that account is necessarily communicated through language, and as such, as should have become apparent by now, language is far from being an accurate or neutral medium through which we can communicate. Bakhtin, of course, argued that language is a social construct that is inherently shot through with the intentions of others, while Saussure identified the inescapable gap that necessarily exists between signifiers and their signified. To my mind, by the time the dream gets communicated to the outside world, either to a therapist or merely a friend, the latent dream material has undergone at least three sets of distortions. Nevertheless, Freud insists that the analyst can work backwards, unpicking and deciphering all of these different levels of distortions, condensations and censorships, in order to understand the meaning of the dream, where the material comes from, and what its significance is for the patient. The extent to which this is really the case, I shall leave for you to decide. The way in which Freud's work on dreams may or may not be applicable to the understanding of literature is probably not immediately apparent yet. But for Freud, there are clear parallels between interpreting dreams and interpreting literature. Freud relates art to the dream along a path, to quote Freud directly, that leads from the investigation of dreams to the analysis of works of imagination, and ultimately to the analysis of their creators, the writers and artists themselves. Freud relates the production of art to mental illness, claiming that the artist is excessively introverted and not far from neurosis. The artist is oppressed by powerful instinctual needs, Freud suggests. He desires to win honour, power, love, wealth, fame, and the love of women. What happens if you're a man? I don't really know. A woman, I mean, I don't really know. But he lacks the means of achieving those satisfactions. Finally, Freud argues, the whole act of producing art is an attempt to fulfil an infantile wish. In interpreting and decoding a work of art, Freud argues, psychoanalysis sees once again an activity intended to allay ungratified wishes, in the first place in the creative artist himself, and subsequently in his audience and spectators. For Freud and subsequent psychoanalytic literary critics, the whole question has been, again to cite Freud, from what source is that strange being, the creative writer, draws his material, and how he manages to make such an impression on us and arouse in us emotions of which perhaps we have not even thought ourselves capable. If we look at this quotation in detail, it immediately appears that the central issue is motivation rather than the relative value of the artwork in question, or indeed its relationship to wider aesthetic, historical or philosophical influences and movements. However, Freud himself, despite comparing the analysis and language of literature to that of the language analysis of dreams, felt that dream work was entirely different from the mature, well-shaped and crucially conscious activities of the writer. But this has not prevented subsequent psychoanalytic literary theorists claiming that dream work is no different to poetic thinking. In his book, The Philosophy of Literary Form, for example, Kenneth Burke argues that Freud's work is crucially important, because it gave us a scientific understanding of literary tropes. Lionel Trilling, in The Liberal Imagination, meanwhile, proposed that Freud's theories were the one branch of psychology that proved that poetry was indigenous to the human mind. Jacques Lacan, meanwhile, has proposed that condensation and displacement are directly comparable to metaphor and metonymy. There are certainly similarities between dream work and creative writing. Both clearly have their origins in wish fulfillment, and both have to make use of various strategies and disguises in order to overcome the resistance of consciousness, if not the dictates of society itself. In other words, in both dreams and creative writing, work is done by the dreamer and the artist to convert the latent content of their thoughts and images into images and narratives that will be culturally acceptable. Metaphor, metonymy and allegory are clearly derived from the work produced, performed in dreams, and are all disguises for wishes or other unconscious material that needs to come to the surface. But to my mind, although parallels clearly exist between dream work and creative writing is a conscious activity. It may draw upon material derived from dreams and unconscious wishes, but writing is a purposeful, active process which writers have conscious control over. In the case of metaphors and allegories, for example, although they are undoubtedly a distortion of or a disguise for an underlying thought, they are often deployed to circumvent political censorship or for the purposes of satire or other conscious decisions. George Orwell's depiction of pigs, horses and sheep in Animal Farm being the obvious case in point. I doubt very much whether in Orwell's case these animals are distortions of his infantile sexual wishes, for example, but you never know. Similarly, in the case of Wordsworth's experiments with forms and images in his lyrical ballads, his aestheticisation of the ordinary was purposeful and integral to his wider moralistic agenda, rather than distortions of his latent thoughts. In his famous preface to Lyrical Ballads, Wordsworth wrote that he envisaged the contemplation of the simplicity of nature, through the descriptions contained within his poems, would hold the individual in a healthful state of association. As a result of such perusals, Wordsworth thought, the individual would find himself in some degree enlightened, his taste exalted, and his affections ameliorated. Each of his poems, then, have what Wordsworth called a worthy purpose, and are thus conscious manifestations of wish fulfillments, as opposed to being akin to partially unconscious, dreamlike effusions. To my mind, then, although there are clearly parallels between dream work and writing, none of them seem entirely satisfactory. The images, the language and images of dream work include elements closer to those of mental derangement than to the aesthetic considerations and careful revision and editing that goes into the production of a piece of literature. To say then, as Lacan does, that condensation and displacement are directly analogous to metaphor and metonymy is only partially correct. The mechanisms are undoubtedly similar, but they operate in entirely different mental states. Even the construction of the works of surrealist writers who claim to write directly from the unconscious cannot be related directly to dream work. In the first manifesto of surrealism written in 1924, André Breton defined surrealism as psychic automatism in its pure state, by which one proposes to express, verbally, by means of the written word, the actual functioning of thought. Such representations, Breton argued, ought to be dictated merely by thought, in the absence of any control exercised over it by reason, and exempt from any aesthetic or moral concerns. Surrealism is free from the obligations of politeness, Breton continued, and is not in any way intended to develop any kind of thesis. Surrealism uses what Breton calls an unrestricted language, but as we have seen, language can never be entirely unrestricted, and surely any proclamation, or in this case manifesto, laying out claims for automatism and unrestricted language, is itself an imposition of the very parameters and definitions they were seeking to avoid. Furthermore, despite the fact that Breton studied Freudian analysis whilst he was serving in the First World War, he seems to have conveniently forgotten Freud's argument that once secondary vision takes place as a way of communicating the manifest dream content, or whatever comes from the unconscious mind, further revision, distortion and censorship is exerted on the censorship, on the distortion and censorship that has already been necessarily imposed upon the material in order for it to pass into consciousness in the first place. Indeed, for Freud, we cannot directly access the unconscious except through deciphering our own distortions, and thus writing from the unconscious, directly from the unconscious, is a blatantly impossible task. We should always be extremely cautious of taking explicit proclamations of impartiality, originality or automatism at face value, for they are nearly always a ruse to encourage the reader to suspend his or her critical awareness for some political, religious or ideological purpose. After all, since when has anything been truly autonomous and unbiased? For Freud himself, the usefulness of his theory of dream work to the study of literature was largely confined to the ways in which the analysis of dreams provided an analytical apparatus that could be used to examine the works of the imagination more generally, and ultimately the minds of their creators. Despite the claims made by Lacan, Burke, Trilling and Bloom for the applicability of Freud's understanding of dream work for literary studies, Freud himself was more modest, and even claimed that psychoanalysis cannot say how the artist achieves his innermost secret concerning how the writer's fantasies and own desire for wish fulfilment becomes creative of aesthetic pleasure in the reader. Freud's own views of the creative process are outlined in his essay on creative writers and daydreaming of 1907, and here he outlines specifically his views of creative writing in relation to wish fulfilment, daydreams, night dreams and fantasy. Freud's understanding of daydreaming and fantasizing derives from his analysis of children's play. For Freud, there are distinct similarities between the child at play and the creative writer, insofar as both are involved in creating imaginative worlds. The child invests a great deal of creative energy in arranging the objects of the world in a manner that is pleasing to him or herself, and such play frequently manifests unfulfilled wishes. However, as we become older, individuals cease to play, or at least when likely to be observed by others. But as Freud rightly points out, hardly anything is harder for a man than to give up a pleasure he has once experienced. Actually, Freud continues, we hardly ever give up anything. We merely exchange one thing for another. What appears to be a renunciation is really the formation of a substitute. As we grow up, Freud proposes, we substitute fantasizing for playing. We start daydreaming. Such fantasizing occurs solely within the mind of the individual because he or she is too embarrassed to disclose them or act them out in front of our peers. Children have no such hang-ups and can thus express their fantasies physically through play. But the everyday responsibilities of adulthood, not to mention the highly influential processes of socialization, mean that it is unacceptable to act out our daydreams. Indeed, as Freud points out, we frequently feel that it is only ourselves that daydream to such an extent and assume that it is far from being widespread. Again, hence our reluctance to disclose our fantasies to others. Freud is careful to distinguish between two forms of writing. Ancient writers of epics and tragedies, Freud argues, cannot be classified as creative writers because they derive their material from pre-existing stories and histories and merely rewrite them. On the other hand, creative writers compose their own material direct from their fantasies and are thus more appropriately classified as imaginative writers. The productions of these individuals closely resemble the erotic or ambitious wishes expressed in daydreams. There is frequently a hero, for example, who conquers adversity and succeeds in triumphing over evil. As Freud rather sarcastically summarises, through this revealing characteristic of invulnerability, we can immediately recognise his majesty the ego, the hero alike of every daydream and of every story. Despite Freud's insistence upon the egocentric nature of every story and every daydream here, Freud does acknowledge that sometimes the ego is content to be merely a spectator rather than a superhero. Psychological novels such as Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, for example, seek to delineate the operations of the main character's thoughts and actions from within. The author sits in the chief protagonist's mind, as it were. An interesting Tolstoy even attempted to do this in the case of A Racehorse. In Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, the writer's ego is again relegated to the role of observer. The author constructs and sits within the mind of the novel's anti-hero, a student who murders an old woman with a borrowed hatchet because he owes her money and cannot afford to repay, and then sinks into a deep and stultifying depression as a result. Nevertheless, for Freud, the ego is still presides over such artistic constructions and fantasies. But rather than dominating proceedings, the ego seeks a form of self-observation by dividing into many part egos, the aim being to personify and observe the conflicting undercurrents of the writer's own internal strifes in several heroes, or in Dostoevsky's case, anti-heroes. We are perhaps getting close here to why Freud suggests that writers were nearly neurotic and unhealthily introverted, even maybe semi or experimentally schizophrenic. For Freud, then, creative writing is a written version of a daydream. Both manifest the same desire for wish fulfilment, and both are, in a sense, substitutes for childhood play. Freud speculates that what instigates creative writing is frequently a memory of an earlier experience, usually from childhood, from which proceeds a wish that needs to be satisfied and finds its fulfilment in the creative work. The work itself, Freud suggests, thus manifests the residue from the recent provoking occasion as well as of the old memory. Before we get too carried away with ourselves and dismiss this formula out of hand, I should point out that Freud himself proposed that this schema was probably inadequate. It should be borne in mind here that his essay on creative writers and daydreaming was originally produced as an informal speech to an audience of around 90 laymen. And throughout the essay, Freud repeatedly emphasised the extent to which our knowledge and his knowledge of the subject of creative writing is distinctly limited. The purpose of the paper was, as he put it at the end, to bring us to the threshold of new, interesting and complicated inquiries, rather than to provide a definitive account of the psychological underpinnings of literature. Nevertheless, his ideas are highly significant and provide us with useful ideas as to how we should interpret literature. One of the most interesting avenues for further inquiry are the implications his suggestions have for psychoanalysing the author. Because literary works contain traces and encodings of underlying wishes and memories, like dreams, they can be interpreted and analysed with a view to deciphering the underlying or latent operations of the author's mind. In other words, as in the case of dreams, literature is merely the manifest content of the author's underlying wishes and desires. Indeed, despite the fact that Freud considers epics and tragedies from the past to be merely unoriginal rewritings of existing stories, myths and legends, even here we can glean information about the author's psychological makeup. Although the writer of epics and tragedies is not in the true sense a creative writer, Freud supposes, the author does retain a certain degree of autonomy, and the work thus contains subtle reworkings of the original narrative that can be extremely insightful. Indeed, Freud goes further, suggesting that maybe the popularity and enduring appeal of ancient myths, folk tales, and even fairy tales point towards the distorted vestiges of wishful fantasies of whole nations. There are clearly a multitude of problems associated with Freud's ideas, and even Freud cannot understand how literature's presentation of the author's fantasies and desire for wish fulfilment produce pleasure in the reader. After all, Freud suggests, if we reveal our fantasies to others verbally, usually the recipient is left entirely cold or even repelled by the imposition. Freud only proposes that the reading of another's fantasies provides some sort of release for the reader, insomuch as the reader is relieved to find that his or her fantasizing is not unique, or indeed cause for embarrassment. But to my mind, there are other more fundamental problems to be borne in mind. If we attempt to psychoanalyze the author by deciphering the coded images, metaphors, and dialogue contained within the text, not only do we run the risk of excluding important historical, political, and ideological facts that might more appropriately explain the meaning and importance of the text than psychoanalysis alone. I'm thinking here about the relevance of the historical method we have been looking at recently in relation to McGann, who warned against focusing on what he calls the artificially restricted geography of the individual associated with psychoanalysis. But more importantly, attempting to extrapolate highly personal psychological information about the author from his or her work has significant ethical implications. Henry James and more recently Alan Bennett have both written explicit or fairly oblique short stories about paedophilia. Does this mean that both authors are closet paedophiles and fantasise about having sex with children? Likewise, can we really say that because Colin McKinn's explores the frustrations of the main protagonist's feelings in relation to Suzette's predilection for spades in Absolute Beginners, that secretly one of his part egos is wondering how he would feel if his wife slept with black men? I'm not sure we can say this, and we would probably be sued if we did. Perhaps we shouldn't delve too deeply into the psychology of the author. Indeed, Oscar Wilde warned against doing so in his preface to The Picture of Dorian Gray. All art is at once surface and symbol, Wilde wrote. Those who go beneath the surface do so at their peril. Those who read the symbol do so at their peril. It is the spectator and not life that art really mirrors. Nevertheless, I don't think we can dismiss psychoanalysis entirely. It does have its uses. Indeed, Freud's reply to Wilde would probably be that he had something significant to hide, hence his warning not to delve too deeply. Likewise, Freud would probably concur with my suggestions about Bennett and McKinn's. We should perhaps consider psychoanalysis not in isolation, but as another tool in what Greenback calls our disciplinary kit, a tool that can reveal insights about the author that other techniques of literary criticism cannot access, but which should not be relied upon to the exclusion of other more verifiable interpretations. Thank you very much.